She didn't stress the piece of it that I think would speak to a theorist, unless you're a condensed matter theorist, unfortunately. But you know, what she is looking at is a new set of materials very related to topological insulators and other materials like that, P-wave superconductors. And the challenge of looking at this is exactly that the physics are multi-body and complicated enough that we don't know where to look for the answer. So you have this huge Hilbert space, and there's a few ways you can look at and see the dynamics, but we don't know in which basis. And if you look in the wrong basis, you either get really complicated answers, or you get answers that don't connect with the physics you want to see. And so she had this nice phase diagram that shows, yes, I can even draw her diagram somewhere. I'll have some to chuck. That down here, she has a superconducting state, so she really knows where to look. Up here, she has a normal state. Again, we really know where to look. And in most materials to date, up here, we'd have an antiferromagnetic state. So we'd really know where to look. And then you would say, well, what's happening here? It's a competition between the superconducting state and the antiferromagnetic state. They're very different properties, but at least you would say, I expect that the basis to be some combination of those, or, you know, reflecting the non-commutivity of those two. In these materials, that state doesn't exist. Okay? So there's two new things happening here, and we don't know what they are. And you can see that when she's looking down here, she gets these nice sharp resonances, because she knows where to look. And when she looks way up here, she gets this nice simple spectra, because she knows where to look. She knows on what basis to look. And around here, she gets these spectra that she calls potatoes, which says essentially that she doesn't understand the structure. No one understands the structure. And we don't know where to look. And that's the challenge of that. And that's the challenge for theorists, to say, yes, the interesting physics would be revealed if you looked in this particular way, right? And you know, remember, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space involving these systems is huge. So if you look in the wrong place, you're just bloody out of luck. Yeah, you have a question.
Yeah, I didn't understand. When you say she doesn't know what basis to look at, what's...
Well, so I have a multi-body process involving 10 to the 14 spins in her sample. They're all interacting with each other. They're all important. So do I try to look at it in a basis where the spins are locally paired? Okay. Or do I try to look at it in a basis where the spins are aligned? But whatever basis I'm looking at, I can't look at the single body terms. I have to look at some multi-body terms. And so you imagine that you take, if I give you, 10 to, we'll take a small number, 10 to the 5 particles. And I say, okay, write down all the operators for that. Okay, so now you take that to the 4th power. And then you say, okay, I allow you to choose 3 of those that we're going to look at. You know, choose wisely. And that's the problem that we have. We could look at many different degrees of freedom, but there are so many we don't know where to look. And the dynamics do not show up in the simple bases that we're used to looking at. They don't show up cleanly in those bases. Yeah? Okay. So I hope it was a fun talk to listen to. Anyways, what I want to do today is to talk about liquid state NMR, so nuclear magnetic resonance,
And by the word liquid state, what I'm saying is here. I'm going to put forth a very simple model of what goes on in the system. We're just going to make a very simple mapping of a quantum information processor to this simple model. Now, this simple model is something that if people try to use it as a complete model of NMR and publish the data, you know, I object as a referee. But it's a simple model that allows us to get our hands around the system. And experimentally, the goal isn't to neglect the other terms in the Hamiltonian. Experimentally, the goal is to implement the system in such a way that the simple model is true, right? So you have to say that's a burden on the experimentalist to make the simple model into the right thing. So what do we have? We have an ensemble of, you know, of order 10 to 17 molecules. The molecules are an interconnected set of atoms. So by interconnected, I mean the spins are interconnected. And a set of atoms, and that is one molecule. Oops. The molecules do not interact with each other. And that's actually a pretty good approximation here. And the system is at thermal equilibrium, so the density matrix is highly mixed. All right. So we start off with the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is going to look like this, and we're averaging always over what's in a molecule. Okay, so if I take, let's take a really simple system. If I take chloroform, then there are two atoms. The C13 is a spin 1/2, the proton's a spin 1/2. The chlorine actually has spin, but it's a quadrupolar nucleus, and it relaxes very quickly, so that you don't see the influence of the relaxation, because on the time scale of the measurement, the T1 relaxation is essentially causing the fluorine nucleus to flip randomly between states. So that we can ignore. All right, so there's two quantum bits. Now, of course, remember that we've already seen that this term, this scalar coupling term, is actually a sigma dot sigma term. And that difference is important. Remember what happened is that if we made the difference in frequencies, if we made, you know, here I have two frequencies, one and two. If I made the difference, omega 1 minus omega 2, that amplitude, much, much bigger than this, then this is a good approximation, right? Yeah. If not, say something.
Sorry, good approximation to the interatomic interaction?
No, thank you. So this term is what we talked about in the strong coupling limit, when we're looking at taking two electron spins and coupling them. And so that term comes from this piece here, comes from a Fermi contact mechanism between two nuclear spins, right? So two nuclear spins share an electronic wave function, and the electron can spend time at each nucleus, and so the electron can polarize the nucleus relative to each other. Okay, and what does it require? It requires that there's a molecular orbital with S character overlapping the two nuclear spins, right? Because otherwise the electron's never going to see the nuclear spins. So this is a Fermi contact term. It's a Fermi contact term. It's isotropic. So we have a term called like sigma dot sigma, ij. And then, of course, the first term is, I'm just going to write the delta omega. Let's just call it 1 and 2. Sigma z1 minus sigma z2 plus and some frequency here. Omega ij. And remember, we expanded this out. We said, oh yes, what happens here is that this looks like sigma plus, sigma minus, plus sigma minus, sigma plus sigma z, sigma z. Right? And if this term is large, these terms are non-secular. Right? This term is large, and the energy difference between the two spins is pronounced. And so if I do a mutual spin flip, it actually costs us energy. So this term becomes non-secular, and then the secular approximation says, ah, you only have to keep this piece. Yeah. So that's what we're doing here. So this is an approximation, but it's a good approximation. This piece, the difference here comes either, as in this case, because we have different nuclear species, and so the geomagnetic ratio is different, or it comes from the chemistry. If I have a system like so, these two carbons are slightly different in their chemistry. So the electron cloud that surrounds them is slightly different. The electron cloud, of course, is going to screen the nucleus from seeing an applied magnetic field, just a Lenz law effect. And so this just reflects the chemistry of the molecule. It says that, yes, every chemically distinct atom has a unique resonance frequency in general. Right. So that's chemistry. No, I'm sorry. I sum within a molecule. Right? So the molecules don't interact. Right? So the Hamiltonian is defined for one molecule, and it's the same for every molecule. Yeah.
So in
this case, so here, if I was looking at the C13s, it would be 4. And let's leave it like that otherwise. The protons are a little bit more complicated. Okay. Now what we would like to do is to have universal control. And remember that if we want universal control, then we need to have a set of operations which, if we looked at the Lie algebra, would span the whole space. In other words, I need a set of operations that if I took all their commutators, and the commutators of the commutators, etc., I could generate a full algebra over, in this case, SU2. And so this, of course, is not going to cut it, right? Because these all commute with each other. So we need some other term. And this piece, called the internal Hamiltonian often, or the drift Hamiltonian if you're in control theory, is time independent, right? That's given by the molecule. It's always there. And so now we have our control Hamiltonian, which is going to be omega 1 sigma x sub I. Okay. And we're just going to choose I from the set within the molecule. Okay. So I can rotate any spin I like. Okay? And now it should be pretty easy to see that we have universal control. If I look at the building up the operator space, we have this simple case, right? Then we say, oh yes, I have polys on the carbon of X, Y, Z, polys on the proton of X, Y, and Z. Of course, you tensor the identity of the proton, tensor identity of the carbon. And then I have the cross terms, right? Poly, X, Y, and Z, carbon, cross. Proton, X, Y, Z. We better end up with 16 terms if we include the identity operator on that space. So these, of course, I can just rotate that to get Y, and I already have the X, and so life is good. I can do that on either of these. This, I could rotate using this to create any state. So if I take this piece of it, sigma Z, 1, 2, and I sandwich it by an operator, e to the I pi over 2, sigma x1. I report, I try to get it right. Right? This would just transform z into y, so we end up with the term sigma y, sigma z, and etc. So we can create everything that we want. Yes, please.
So, for example, in that protonic acid, what would be your control?
So the control would be that I would rotate this spin, or I'd rotate that one, or that one.
Any one of the carbons.
Yes. So at the moment, let's just talk about it as a four-qubit system. When we do experiments, we actually use the protons too, so we can get 7 qubits out of it. But we're going to run out of time anyway, so let's just talk about it as just a 4-qubit. Yeah, so our system is, we have a synthesizer, it goes through an amplifier, it goes through a gate. Up here we have a magnet, there's an RF coil in it. And the synthesizer sets a frequency, right? So I can say, oh yes, let's go to one of these frequencies. And the gate tells me the time that I want to apply that energy for. So, you know, these are under computer control. And now we can do anything we want. And remember, you know, there's some details, but they're not so important. We look at the off-resonance effect. So if I have two spins, I have a Hamiltonian that says I have omega 1 sigma z1 plus omega 2 sigma z2. Just keep that piece of it. And then I apply an RF pulse in this frame, right? So I have e to the I omega 1 over 2 t sigma z sigma x e to the minus I omega 1 over 2 t sigma z, right? This is going to be the RF Hamiltonian. It says, I want to put an omega R here. It says, hey, I'm going to rotate sigma y to be in this frame of reference, right? Okay. And then we say, oh yes, we know how to do this, right? We go into an interaction frame based upon this piece. And this term, of course, since it has the same frequency dependent, drops out. This term becomes time independent. We take the rotating wave approximation, so just keep your good piece. This piece picks up a different frequency, right? Because we're going to subtract omega 1 from it. So now the Hamiltonian in the rotating frame is equal to delta omega sigma z2 plus omega r sigma x1. Yeah? I'm going to leave it like that. There's some details. Let me forget the details. But now I can control spin 1. And spin 2 will just pick up a phase term. Yes?
So this RF is radio frequency, that RF is rotating frame, right?
So this one is just the amplitude of that pulse. Okay? So it says how strong that amplifier is. Okay? So we can because there's a frequency difference here, we can selectively rotate each of the spins. Yeah?
Do you do it on a bigger molecule, like on a polymer?
Yes, you can. As you would guess, there's a range of frequencies for omega 1. And it's finite. And you keep trying to stick things in there, and they get closer and closer. And the closer they are, the longer it takes you to get the selectivity you want. So that's one of the reasons that liquid state NMR, in many approaches, don't scale for a quantum computer. But yes, we've done experiments on up to 13 spins in liquid state. You know, for that purpose, it wouldn't be hard to do things at about the level of 20 spins. But it wouldn't be a lot of fun. But we have the technology, we could do that. Yes, please.
Okay. I have a question about that interaction between there. So did you do a thing in rotating frame and then somehow get sigma or sigma bit?
No, what I did, and thanks for the question, is I said, let me give a pulse here.
Okay.
So let's go through that. And let's take the let's go back to this toggling frame representation. So let's say I had a molecule that had three spins in it, and so I look at these terms: sigma z 1, sigma z 2, sigma z 1, sigma z 3, sigma z 2, sigma z 3. Right? Those are those. If I have three atoms, that's everything I would have in this term. And then I say, hey, I want to have a control not just between 1 and 3. Right? So this conditional gate is going to allow me to look at a control not. Okay, so I want to have just this conditionality here. How do I get rid of these things? And then I say, wow, okay. I know that if I give a pi pulse, and I give a pi pulse about the one axis, I can go into the interaction frame of that pi pulse. So they go into the toggling frame, as we talked about last class, I think, and look at how this transforms. And a pi pulse will be about, let's say, y. We'll take z to minus z. Right? So if I just had this sequence, then it would say, oh, well, this term will evolve positively here and will evolve with a negative sign there because it has that one. And this one will do the same thing. And this one will be positive in both. And so, oh, well, with one pi pulse, I can distinguish between these two and this one. Okay? In fact, I can make, if I have these two times exactly the same, I can make it appear that these two terms go to zero over that period of time. But I wanted to keep this one. Alright, so that's not so good, right? I say, oh, how am I going to do that? Well, if I put a pi pulse on both 1 and 3, right, then this term is going to be positive in both of those cases, right? Because we're going to say, oh yeah, I've got to invert 1 and invert to 2. So then we say, oh, okay, now we have immediate gratification because we've kept that one and lost those two. And this sort of thing is very, very easy to generalize. And then we have your question. It says, hey, I don't want this to be z. I want this to be x. And so then we would put a pi over 2 y pulse for the one spin, and a pi over 2 minus y pulse on the one spin surrounding it. right? So we would transform Z into X, and then everything goes on just as it did before. Yeah. So that's how we do it. So we can build all these things up.
Okay, I have another question.
Good.
Where does the control Hamiltonian come from?
So it comes from applying this particular field here. So it says that yes, I have one more field and I can turn it on and off at my desires.
Okay.
Good. Now, having done all this, we would say, well, what's the natural language that we should be talking about in terms of controlling the system? And our operations would be that we could apply some angle of rotation over some number of spins about an axis x, y, minus x, or minus y, right? So I could do any rotation of individual spins. And we could do these couplings. So I could allow it to evolve as sigma z, ij for some other angle where I can choose I and j to be anything I want. Okay? And those would be the natural things. And so you know, it's not the language that a computer scientist would like, but it's universal control. And it is trivial to take any algorithm and translate it into this, right? So we could always do that. And as you do that, it's useful to keep a few rules. So if we had a control not yet is sigma x So E plus and minus are just idempotents, and the way you're going to read this is that if the B spin is down, flip the A spin, if the B spin is up, leave the A spin alone, right? So that's a control knockout. And since these are idempotents, then by definition, and even in fact, they square to themselves, and they have the nice property that if you look at the cross term, it's zero. So there's an approach called geometric algebra that allows you trivially to look at, take this and reduce it to a set of operations. And there's just one little rule that I want to get the sign right for that's useful. And so let me just add this one to here. So e to the a e plus minus is equal this is true provided that A commutes with E plus minus. It's a trivial thing to prove. But it's a useful approach because it allows us to go from a list of actions to a set of unitaries, okay, which we can relate back to a Hamiltonian. Okay, and we're going to run out of time, but if I take this piece here and I use this rule, it's easy to show as an example. Hey. why I keep putting pluses there? There are no pluses. Okay. That. Those two are equivalent. I sent you a Mathematica notebook. You'll have a look. But it doesn't need it. So he says, oh, hey, look. There's some bloody overall phase. We throw away bloody overall phases. We have a rotation of the first spin, okay, that depends on, that is an angle of pi over 2. So this piece says, oh yeah, do theta, do pi over 2 about x for spin 1. This piece says, I'd like to do a z rotation of pi over 2 about z for spin 2. Comes from this term. Now we could use these RF pulses, of course, to generate a z rotation. Right? An x pulse and a y pulse to generate a z rotation. But if we've got it there, so we don't need to do that. And this piece says, oh, well, I want an xz rotation, but we have the zz rotation. So we're going to say, well, we don't want to really do an xz rotation. So I'm going to do a pi over 2 pulse about y for spin 1. Then we're going to do the zz rotation. Okay, and that's going to be a pi over 2 zz rotation. So that's 1 and 2. And then we'll need to go back and have a pi over 2 about minus y for spin 1. Yeah?
So the last factor, by that? Because that's not the exponent is not imaginary. Oh, I see, right.
Thanks.
So, yeah, it's like.
So, okay, it's all there. So there's a simple pulse sequence that implements the control knot, puts it back into the language we want over here, so we have a nice mapping. And, you know, you can see it's efficient. By efficient, I never had to, if I had a larger Hilbert space, I wouldn't have to include the whole Hilbert space in any of this mapping. Every element of the mapping is a local element. Yeah. Okay. Now this doesn't solve all the problems. It says that we have control. It turns out that getting control in quantum computing is mostly an easy piece, because quantum computing doesn't say you need these control elements. It says you need to span this space, right? So control is not usually the hard part. The difficult piece here is a combination of those two terms. So let's talk about that. If I look at the density matrix at equilibrium, then it's equal to the identity plus epsilon, the sum of sigma z sub I. Okay, and epsilon is about 10 to the minus 5, depending upon temperature, field, other things. But, you know, it's 10 to the minus 5. So the first thing you see is that we have a sum of just one body terms, right? It says that the energy is defined spin by spin, not over the whole system. And of course, what would we like? Well, we'd like to have the density matrix. Yeah. Put as many zeros there as you want. Just overlap the fully polarized state. And if I said, well, here we're talking about spin operators, let's reduce this to a set of spin operators, then for two spins, this is equal to the identity plus sigma z1 plus sigma z2 plus sigma z1 sigma z2. Right, so it's easy enough to see. If I take the basis set, right, so we look at up, 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 down, down, up, down, down. Right. Then we say, okay, you know, the identity is one in all of these. Sigma Z, one, looks like that. Sigma Z, two, looks like that. And Sigma Z, one, Sigma Z, two, looks like that. And if you add them all up, you get the projection you want, right? So life is good. It just says, yes, this is the piece I want. And we have this piece, right? But I don't have that piece. And of course, the challenge is, if I go to three spins, right, then I wouldn't have the Z1, Z2 term, I wouldn't have the Z2, Z3 term, I wouldn't have the Z1, Z3 term, and I wouldn't have the term, the three-body term, Z1, Z2, Z3. And I need them all. And if I went to N spins, then I would see that effectively there is, I'm missing the number of terms that goes to dimensionless space. Right? And so you can see that this is going to be bloody inefficient to do. The next thing you recognize is that these two things do not have the same eigenvalues, right? So there's no way that I'm going to be able to apply a unitary to get me from here to here. I have to do something non-unitary. And it's very easy to do something non-unitary. It says, oh, I've got sigma z. We've already seen that I can rotate sigma z into sigma z, sigma z. I have that control, right? We have universal control. So what we do is we take this and we map it into what we call the pseudo-pure state. It looks like this. Where eta is less than epsilon divided by the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay, so this I can do. It's a non-unitary process. But there are many ways we can do non-unitary things. Okay, so I can define a Krauss map that does this. Life is good. It'll be CP, so it'll be implementable, but it'll cost us big time. Yeah? Okay, so that is what we do. And now when we do the computation, we neglect this piece here, right? There's our computer sitting over here. Yeah? Now there's another problem, challenge, with looking at NMR, is that we're never going to see an individual spin, right? We have an ensemble of 10 to 17 spins. And so the magnetization that we observe is going to be the expectation value averaged over those 10 to 17 spins. So to go back to our picture over here, we've got our sample, 10 to the 17 molecules in there. And there's a coil around it. And we're going to send that to a preamplifier. And so the way you want to think about this piece is that the EMF in that coil is equal to the integral of the magnetization as a function of time. That's the time derivative of this. Dotted into the field of the coil, suitably normalized, integrated over all space. Okay, so it's this dot product of the field, which is a macroscopic large field, and the spin magnetization, which is the sum of the magnetic moments over all the spins in the sample. right? So this thing is equal to the sum of, in this case, sigma x sub I over now the entire sample. So we have a bulk magnetic moment in the sample. So if I took NMR, if I took a sample and I put it into an NMR system and I let it be polarized by this, so now we have spins pointing up or down and we have a magnetic, then of course there's a paramagnetic effect. Okay, and if I was careful about measuring the weight of the sample, I would see that the weight changed because there's a force on the sample from this magnetism in the sample. And it's this bulk magnetism that we measure. So we can't measure an individual spin. Let's see what happens for that. Let's say I want to do quantum error correction. So I have some arbitrary state. And we'll do error correction. And so I have three spins in my molecule. So I have a molecule a little bit more complicated than we talked about, but we have three spins in the molecule. And I can prepare a pseudo-pure state over three spins. So that's no problem. We know that we can prepare a set of controlled NOT gates, right? That's a piece of cake. And so at this point here, we would have this correlated state, that the state at that point would look like this, right? Yeah, we took this, tensored it with two zeros, did two control NOT gates. We have this entangled, potentially entangled state of the GHZ type of class. This code corrects for sigma x errors. And so if I allow a sigma x error to happen, well, I'll get this state, or I'll get that state. You know, just allow a single spin flip, and there's three errors that a single spin flip can introduce into the system. So with some probability, hopefully the bulk of it, we return the state that we put in. With some probability for a single spin flip, we would get each of these three terms. The decoding of this state is exactly the same as the encoding after the errors, of course. And so we would end up here back where we wanted. Here we end up with an error. Here we end up without an error. And here we end up without an error. Okay, so we have this nice density matrix right here. The density matrix at this point says, hey, I have psi sitting here. Okay, conditional on these two being zero, right? So it's sitting up in that subspace. And it says, oh, yeah, in this subspace, I have psi. And over here, I have psi. And in this subspace, right here, I have sigma x times psi. Right? And what allows us to do error correction is that these subspaces don't overlap, so that we can individually address them. And of course, you know, there's an amplitude in each of these, right? This is 1 minus 3p, p, p, p. Everything's good. And then if you look at Peter Shor's paper, what Peter says is, hey, make a measurement here And then based upon that measurement, apply a classical control operation here, which is x, to remove this piece here. And what's the measurement you want to make? You want to say, hey, are both of these spins up? Right? So under the condition that both of those are up, we're going to apply that gate. All right. Now, we can't do that in that fashion in NMR. Because what's going to happen? Well, I make a measurement of these two spins, but I make a measurement over the entire ensemble, right? So now I'm tracing out that information, and I'm doing it in a nasty way, and I'm combining these states, right? So the thing that I absolutely don't want to do is I don't want to make a measurement and then do something. So what I must do is instead of doing this, I need to do this controlled operation, the so-called Toffoli gate, that says rotate this spin conditionally on those. Make no classical measurements. Just do that as a unitary process. And then there's an important step. Once you've done that, once I've done this, right now I have a density matrix that looks like psi in all of these spaces. And then I trace over those two spins, trace. And this collapses down to a pure 2x2. Yep, okay.
You're tracing over the psi and the, one of the ancillaries. Did you want?
No, I didn't want to do that.
Right,
So everything's wrong.
I know what you wanted to do, so yes.
Thank you. I should pay attention. So that's what we wanted to do. And of course what Peter said, now I've changed the color, sorry about that. Peter says measure here. And then based upon these, do a controlled X operation. Yeah, we've done that. The ancillaries are still the ancillaries. Perfect. Sorry about that. Okay, so you can see that you have to respect how you're making your measurement and to say that I'm not going to get any information that I can if I have an ensemble of systems, then I'm getting information across the ensemble. You know, that's very nice because we can say, oh yes, I can get an expectation value like that. I don't have to average for over and over and over to get an expectation value. So that's the good part. The bad part is that I only get an expectation value and that sometimes the action that I want to apply is not conditional on the expectation value, it's actually conditional on the state of a particular qubit. Yeah. Okay. Now, I need to show you just one more thing, and then you'll know it all.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Here we are using the machine code to like take care of those errors, that kind of errors. So is it something like this is just easy to implement, or what about the other more powerful encoding machines like 9-qubit code?
Sure. We can do. I mean, the 9-qubit code is developed from the perspective of a computer scientist,
yeah.
And so you know, you can show that the 9-qubit code fits into 5 qubits, and a computer scientist doesn't care about that. But let me tell you, an experimentalist, we care about that, right? So when we develop codes, you know, count the number of error modes there are. Tells you the dimension of your Hilbert space, okay, and then build a compact code. So the 9-qubit code, you can fit into 5 qubits, and that's been done, okay. We've done concatenated error correction. We've done infinite depth codes, noiseless subsystems, decoherence-free subspaces. So all of that has been demonstrated in labs.
Yeah, I mean, does it like get exponentially difficult to do that when you get more and more qubits?
No. No. I mean, of course, it's exponentially difficult if you're looking at an ensemble to prepare the pseudo pure state, right? Because that costs us the dimension of the Hilbert space. But other than that, there's no other exponential in the problem. Okay. So now, over here, we show how we're going to detect the signal. We're going to detect the signal by saying that we look at an EMF induced in the coil by the spins. And if I have an EMF across a coil, then I better have a current across the coil. And if I have a current across the coil, then the current has to rotate, has to produce a field, and it's going to rotate the spins back. And so NMR in many things are often viewed as though we have a so-called weak measurement, that the measurement process doesn't change the state of the system. And we can go back and indicate that using the Planck equations, right? Remember the Planck equations, we're just talking about one spin now. The Planck equations are isomorphic to single qubit dynamics. So this is a complete picture. So we have a term that is delta omega sigma y minus sigma x over T2. Okay, so there's the Planck equations that tells us how the magnetization, mx, my, and mz, evolves in time. So the magnetization, again, is this ensemble average over the spins. And it says, oh yes, there's this precession term, which is this term. I've just gone into an interaction frame, so it's delta. But that's and there's this relaxation term that you've calculated. It has the dephasing and the T1, the thermal equilibrium. And I have to add this term here, m sub 0, because there's an equilibrium value, right? So we want the system to return to equilibrium. So that's what that term will do. So that is generally seen as a complete dynamics of the spin system. And the saying that you have a weak measurement says that this is the complete and correct picture of the dynamics. Okay, so now let's put in this term, this back action. You know this can't be the complete picture. Because imagine what would happen if I had T1 and T2 very long. I take my spin system, it's polarized, and I rotate it. So I've put energy into the system. Now the spin system evolves, and we generate an EMF across the coil, right? So now we're getting power out, right? Voltage across the coil is going to generate power. If T1 and T2 are infinitely long, the spins would precess forever, and we would violate the second law. You know, life would be really good if we could get as much power out of the system as we want. Okay? So nothing like cold fusion in this lab. In this room, right? We only can get out what we put in. Okay, so we need to add in a term, and the term is going to be nonlinear, as you would expect for a classical term. Now, where does the nonlinear come into play quantum mechanically? It comes into play quantum mechanically because what I should do is describe this coil in terms of a quantum oscillator, so via Jane's coming, and then the Planck equations are going to be what happens when I trace over that Jane's-Cumming interaction, right? And so yes, we can get to nonlinearity into the system. Quantum mechanics is not nonlinear. It's the fact that we're tracing over that operation that gives us a nonlinearity. So let's just write down the effect of nonlinearity because it's very easy to write out to write out classically. He says there's a bilinear effect that based upon the strength of the signal on the x-axis, we're rotating the system back to z. Okay? The same thing happens here. Based upon the strength of the signal on the y-axis, we're rotating the spins back to z. And of course, we need to keep everything nice. Yeah, that's all correct. So this piece here has lots of names. It's called radiation damping, unfortunately. It's also called super radiance. But all it is, neither of those work very well. All it is a back action of the measurement process. And what's the influence of that? It's a rotation, right? It's not that we're losing any information. It's just that we're rotating the system back into the z-axis. And notice that both of these signs are negative. You rotate back, regardless of where you are, you always rotate back to the z-axis, okay? So that's why we don't like the word damping, because there's no damping here. T sub r is, let's just call that F. It depends upon the quality of your measurement system. So it says that there's a filling factor. It says, did you fill your coil with spins? Right? It's boring. But yeah, you have to put it there. The quality factor is the quality factor of the coil. It says, what's the stored energy of the coil versus the dissipated energy? Remember that we're following the energy flow. So if the coil's dissipating a lot of energy, then we're not going to see this effect. If the coil's not dissipating much energy, then there's time for the spins to rotate back. And this is just, again, the thermal equilibrium signal. So the strength of the magnetization, it's just the normalization. It says the more magnetization we have, okay, the stronger this dipole-dipole effect will be. Right? It's just a dipole-dipole influence between the coil and the spins, putting things back where they were. Okay, so here, this shows correctly that there is no such thing as a weak measurement that doesn't perturb the sample. If you make a measurement, you have to perturb it, right? Now you can perturb it in a very small way. Right? You have the control over what that value tau sub r is. Right? But you always perturb it. Okay? If I make a measurement, I'm taking energy out of the system, necessarily I'll be rotating the system back to where it should be. Okay? So that's unfortunately all the time we have. It would be fun to continue. You know where my lab is? Come by with questions. In particular, thinking about this NV center problem that I posed, there's lots of questions in thinking about using that NV as a repeater. And very basic questions in that we haven't worked out the details. And so if anyone, you know, has some ideas and thinking about it, come by, because we probably don't have the ideas that you've come up with, and it'd be fun to talk about them. Okay, thanks.
So I'd like to present you with our 2011 PSI shirt.
Right. Thank you very much.
For the work you've done.
It's always fun.
Yes, and hope we have you back next year.
Okay, once you come back.
We can discuss that.
Thank you.
I'm from the students.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.